Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Hi, everybody.
Wouldn't it be such a cliche if we went right into the Adam and Eve promo?
Well, it seems to be what happens all the time. Every time we start the show, we start telling people how they can get 50% off of one item and three DVDs and a mystery gift and free shipping in the U.S. And all they have to do is go to adamandeve.com and put in the promo code STATIC. They also get a nice warm feeling that they're helping us keep the lights on.
In your case, you'd say that. It was such a cliche.
Every time we say the same thing.
So obviously tonight we're talking about cliches.
Exactly. Now, I got to tell you this. You know, I'm taking... You remember when I used to do Road Trip to Oblivion with Jason Oblivion, and that was our little audio drama. It's got 100 episodes on his website, jasonoblivion.com. And my character is in limbo right now, and it ends up that I'm going to break the news. I am not coming back for season 7, except for maybe a guest appearance here and there. However, I'm working on starting my own audio drama. Now get this. It's going to be a buddy cop drama, okay? One guy is going to be like 3 days from retirement, and I'm thinking in the very first episode, an alien comes down and shoots him. His last words, of course, are, "I'm too old for this shit." Wait a minute. Why are you looking at me like that? I think this is a good script. Brilliant and original.
Well, let's start before we get all goofy. Let's just define, at what point does something become cliche? How many times does a certain trope in storytelling have to be used before it becomes the cliche?
How many roads must a man walk down before people punch him in the face?
Exactly. Because like I was describing to you the plot of To Live and Die in L.A. when you were out having a smoke before the
right.
show.
Loaded with cliches.
You know, it's got the two agents who are one older, one younger, who are partners. One is 2 days away from retirement, and he gets killed by the villain. So the partner, the younger, more brash one, has to go off the grid, and he can, you know, only solve the case when he's been taken off the case and breaks all the rules and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, God, that is totally cliched.
Yeah, the chief yells at him and calls him a loose cannon.
Yeah, and that actually happens. And and then I pointed out to you, this was the first movie that did this.
Yeah.
This was the movie that would lay the groundwork for the cliche. So is it fair to say it's cliched since it's the one that did all this when that wasn't such?
Taken out of its historical context, yes.
Like all these Blu-ray reviews that call it one of the most cliched cop movies ever, when in actuality it's one of the most original and unique cop movies out there.
You told me that Shakespeare was full of cliches.
Because it was.
But he was the originator of many of these cliches.
But he also perpetuated them in his own work. Every one of his works, and I don't mean every literally, most of his works use the same tropes over and over, so he cliched himself, which is a cliche, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, you can tell a Shakespeare play because it's a Shakespearean play, just like you can tell a Lucasian film because it's a Lucasian film.
What? Well, then why do we fall into these cliches? Why? Because it's got to be something with the audience, Scott. Let's just stay with movies for a moment, okay? Why in the late 80s to early 90s could the cop only solve the case after he'd been taken off the case? Why was that something that writers went to again and again and again? Is that bad writing? Or they knew what the audience wanted?
I think, believe it or not, I think that this hero's story actually goes back to mythology. And I think it's something that hits us an emotional chord deep inside. I really do. You know, the hero who against all odds gets his family back and saves the day and saves the world. It's been told since the days of Gilgamesh and Kidu and all of that. And it's, I think that there is something deep in our reptile brains that this strikes an emotional chord. And I think in the 80s and 90s, when if you look at the world around, it was the underdog, and this was during the days of the tech bubble, it was the underdog and the one, the guy that went against the grain and came up with something new and ended up a multimillionaire. I think it spoke to the audience at that point. And I think the story of the underdog in general has always spoken to audiences, and that's why you see it in myth and you know, going even back to Greek mythology and, again, the Bhagavad Gita and stuff like that.
But so. You don't think it got incredibly repetitive when every cop movie... I mean, it got to the point where by the early 90s, when the action movie genre was kind of starting to taper off for a while there, that you knew the cop was never going to catch the killer until he did something to get himself suspended. It became a cliche that became paint by numbers.
And that's lazy film writing.
That's what I'm saying. Why? Is it just lazy film writing? Or were they giving the audience, not necessarily what they wanted, but what they wanted? No, what had proven effective in the past. Because you know how unoriginal Hollywood is. So they said, this worked the last three times. Let's just do it again.
And I think that may have something to do with it, too. And that may be, you know... make movies quickly, cheaply, and get them out there and make sure that it's something that again, strikes that chord with the audience. And there you go. I think really it was retool it this way, rewrite this story, do these little tweaks, and boom, we've got our movie. I mean, we've got cliches now with the zombie genre that has been out for... you know, since the 60s or even before in
the modern
independent cases.
But. The zombies as we think of them today,
yes,
originated with Romero's Night of the Living Dead in 1968. Prior to that, zombies were more of the voodoo variety.
The voodoo, okay, like in that James Bond film.
I'm not a Bond fan.
I can't remember which one it was. But anyway, you know, now we have cliche zombies. Of, you know, until, what, 28 days later, it was the cliche.
First of all, they're not zombies.
Hang on. Until 28 days later, which if you, yeah, I know they're technically not zombies, but it's a zombie film, really. Let's be honest. The cliche of the zombie was the slow rambling. Yeah, one zombie on its own is pretty easy to handle.
Actually,
but when you've
Return of the Living Dead 1985 had the fast zombies.
Oh, okay.
That was the first one. And that was also the one that brought brains. Instead of them just eating flesh, that's the one where they went after brains, weirdly enough, became the cliche even when, like in popular culture, you see all this zombie stuff where they go, brains, and you go, no, different kind of zombie, different film, never mind. You know, it's one of those, never mind, you've kind of mushed two different cliches together to form a new one.
And we've also, you know, we've even seen it in video games. What was the name of that one game where you're in the mall? They made like two sequels to it too.
Dead Rising?
Yes, thank you. Dead Rising. You know, and it's, I see that and I see it as cliche today, and even Walking Dead is kind of playing with some of those cliches.
Well, and you can even have, in a weird way, especially when it comes to film, you can have cliches that are so un-cliché they become cliché. Does that make sense?
No, please explain what the hell you're talking about.
Well, you get something like The Walking Dead, which you brought up. They've gotten to the point where, in the early episodes, they kind of broke cliché with no character is safe. Any character can die at any time. Now, you know that. Every time a character is in mortal danger now, they kill that character. So the whole no character is safe has become the cliche now. Uh-huh. That every time you think the character is going to get out of it, they don't. They've done that like 9 times now to the point where that's now the cliche. Do you see what I mean? How it morphed into some mutated anti-cliche that becomes the cliche?
So in answer to your first question of how many times, we've decided on 9. We're only 10 minutes into the show, Josh, and you've just ended it.
Well, that would be the cliche, wouldn't it?
There we go. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Oh, go on.
You know, sorry. But you also have, like, look at some of the things that started cliches. Let's just stick with pop culture movies and stuff for the moment. Like, look at 1971 being the watershed year for the Rogue Cop. Look at all the cop movies that came out before 1971. The cops were good guys, followed the rules, and got the bad guy to prison.
Sure.
Then Dirty Harry came out in 1971. Yep. And he was totally unique for movies. Then everyone tried to copy him. And Dirty Harry became the cliche.
So my question is, how you look at Dirty Harry now and you talk about
Dirty Harry. Are you talking the character or the first movie?
The first movie. You talk about that movie now, and people don't go, oh, yeah, that's cliched as hell. They go, no, that was groundbreaking at the time. How come that film stays in its historical context? And it is a good movie.
One of the things, and this is really the really weird thing about the first Dirty Harry,
yeah.
Most people don't realize it was 71. They're like, God, I thought that was a late 70s, early 80s thing. And it's like, no, man, that was early that happened.
But that's what I'm saying is, how come that one stays in its historical context? Whereas you mentioned, what was that movie that you...
To Live and Die in L.A.
To Live and Die in L.A. And reviews come out going cliche after cliche after cliche when Dirty Harry did the same thing, but...
I think because of the fact that Dirty Harry became a pop cultural icon.
Okay.
And really only film nerds know To Live and Die in L.A.
Ah,
I think it was due to... Ironically enough, Dirty Harry had a higher saturation level, so it had a higher awareness. Does that make sense?
Thanks a lot to what we talked about last week, marketing.
Exactly. But then, you know, you've also got, you know, like the cliches within TV, like, oh my God, if this is to me the fallback of every hack TV writer, and they do it again and again. If I'm watching one more TV show where this happens, I quit immediately.
Okay, which one's that?
You've got the guy who's in love with a girl who only sees him as a friend, but she's got a boyfriend who he hates. And so you got this unrequited love triangle that is the most trite, unoriginal, uninspired, wacky comedy bullshit I've ever seen. I can count 5 different TV shows right now on the air that use this trope, and it's like, oh my God, are we still doing this?
Give me 5. Nope. Give me your 5 examples.
Oh, I tried to high-five him because I was being a smartass.
Yeah, give me your 5 examples.
Okay, the first one, I actually think it just got canceled. So, but Breaking In.
Okay.
That was, other than that cliche, was a pretty decent
show.
Well, it was kind of a comedy-ish.
Okay.
I don't know about the new episodes, but the Big Bang Theory definitely had that in the early ones, at least. I don't know if that's...
They've gotten away from that, thank God.
2 and a Half Men did that.
2 and a Half
Again,
Men. Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't watched a non-Charlie Sheen episode, so I don't know if that's still...
I don't know. I stopped watching while Charlie Sheen was still on them, but...
Well, I stopped watching like the first season, but I've seen other ones.
Glee, I'll give you that one, Glee.
Okay, I don't watch Glee, but yeah. Okay. NCIS.
I haven't watched Glee in like 3 seasons, 2 seasons.
NCIS. I know CSI did that.
Yeah.
Actually, most cop procedurals do that.
Yes.
You know? So, I mean, that probably bumps into double digits right there.
Sure, sure.
Why? Why do we fall back on that?
Why
is that such a go-to?
I think, again, it's something that it's one story that everybody can relate to because every single one of us have had that unrequited love. And so it's an easy way to make a character relatable.
But it's now seen as a cliche. So isn't that a negative selling point? That don't you want to try and buck the cliche?
No, I don't. And this is weird. It's because people that are fans of those shows either don't care or don't realize it. I mean, look at Friends. Friends and the whole Ross and Rachel shebang that happened during that series. You know, will they get together? Are they getting together? Oh, they got together, and at the very end they had a baby. Woo! You know, real fans of Friends were watching that, and they were so invested in these characters' lives and in these characters' happenings that they didn't realize that there were that they were watching a cliche. And I think that's a big part of it. Or they didn't care. One or the other.
Well, okay, then what about when something bucks a cliche so much that on the surface, something like St. Elsewhere, oh, it's a doctor show. It's a hard-hitting doctor show that deals with serious issues. In a way, that's kind of a cliche. But they used unpredictability. And I'm not just talking about the ending. They used unpredictability in such a way that I think they were something truly special. I mean, you could... That in Hill Street Blues,
yeah,
bucked every cliche you could because you never knew what was going to happen.
Right.
I mean, there was one episode where they're just in the ER. It's a normal episode, and a drunk driver drives his car through the building, and hits a bunch of doctors and patients. And you go, what the? Who the fuck would have seen that coming?
Yeah, and since then you've had ER. Who used the same kind of unpredictability.
But it was a predictable unpredictability.
Exactly. And House.
Which is a cliche in and of itself.
Right. And House, which...
No, House was absolutely cliche. You knew he was going to make three wrong diagnoses at the 50-minute mark before he'd come to the correct diagnosis, and they always saved the patient. That show was absolute cliche.
Okay.
House embraced how unoriginal it was.
Except for the last season. The last season when they got away from him diagnosing patients and taking care of patients and started concentrating on House himself, then they fell back on other cliches to the point that he rammed his car into his potential, whatever the hell the medical director's name was, Cuddy. He rammed his car into her house and, ooh, who saw that coming? And stuff like that.
But, you know, you've got these paint by the numbers, like Medium. My wife watched Medium all the time. Blech. And I really like Patricia Arquette, though. And I do, too.
I was ashamed of Medium was not a good show for her.
Actually, the first season and the last season were pretty good. It was meh in the middle. The last season, when it moved from NBC to CBS and they had a lot more creative freedom, it got a lot better. And the first season, when the cliches hadn't been established yet. But you knew every episode. She was the first segment, something weird was going to happen with characters you've never seen before. Then she was abruptly going to wake up. They'd go to the opening segment, and then she would be trying to solve the mystery of what happened in the beginning. It was paint by number. Harlan Ellison used to say about 70s TV, he said something like Columbo or Kojak. You watch the first 5 minutes, you turn it off, you go read a book. You come back and watch the last 5 minutes, you've got the entire story. Because they were so paint by numbers, you knew exactly where every single thing was going to fall. And that's what 70s cop shows were. That's what most 80s cop shows were. It's definitely what 90s cop shows were, with the exception of Homicide: Life on the Street, which, again, the executive producer of that was one of the head writers on St. Elsewhere. So he brought that true unpredictability where we're just going to kill a main character. No buildup, no foreshadowing. Just, hey, he's Blah. A cop. He's a cop. He got shot.
Yep.
Deal with it. You know, with the exception of that, I mean, TV is built on cliches. Look at soap operas. You know, look at how in the late 80s, certain like Saturday Night Live and Fridays and that were parodying how ridiculous soap operas got with like, and the Egyptian princess was brought back from the dead and now she's in a love triangle with the doctors and all this and... Now that's actually what's happening on the soap operas. They got that ridiculous.
What was the... Oh, Passions, I think, was the name of it. The soap opera that made fun of soap operas.
Yeah. Passions, from what I saw, because when I worked at Channel 2, they ran that. So I always caught the last 5 or 10 minutes when we started to do scripts. And that one, it seemed like it was trying really hard to be Dark Shadows for a new generation.
Yeah, it really was.
And it was like, hey, what if we took Days of Our Lives and crossed it with Dark Shadows?
Yeah.
And that didn't work, man.
No. And well, let's face it, even Dark Shadows fell into some cliches.
Oh, well, hell, Dark Shadows didn't even have monsters or anything for the first 100 or so episodes.
Right.
It was just kind of a gothic mystery, and then werewolves and vampires start showing up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you know, weird stuff.
Yeah, that just got weirder. But I think TV doesn't embrace anything that breaks the cliche, and I think that's the fault of the audience. Because whenever you do have something unique, whenever you do have something that is original and is not cliched, it tanks and nobody watches it. So I blame the audience for that. They want their cliches. They want to know that the good guy is going to win at the 55-minute mark. They want to know the guy is going to get the girl.
I can kind of see the point of that, though. Especially if you look at TV as a passive, mindless escapism. If you look at TV as a passive, mindless escapism, we don't want the deep story. We don't want the unpredictability. Why do you think sitcoms are so damn popular? I mean, even bad sitcoms, they're comfortable. They're a comfortable place to go. I can turn off my brain.
But see, I try and watch TV to expand my mind. That's the same reason I try and read. I read because I want to learn something. I want to get engaged in a story, not just go, oh my God, this is paint by fucking numbers.
If I want to learn, I'll read.
You know, I mean, it's just like,
if I want to learn, I'll go to the internet.
You know, and I like this filmmaker I'm about to bring up, okay?
Okay.
But he has done this in every single script he's ever written.
Quentin Tarantino, one of your favorites.
No. James Cameron.
Okay.
He uses film school screenwriting 101. Every 10 minutes, you have an action scene. Every 5 minutes, you have an emotional beat.
Sure.
Go and time out any one of his movies. They time out to that exactly.
Yeah. I'm thinking of Titanic and Avatar.
And I think that is so fucking lazy that it's just, I don't want to learn to get better at this. I just will follow screenwriting 101, and I'm now a billionaire because of it. So clearly that's what the audience wants. They don't want me to try to do anything different.
And again, if you look at film or TV as escapism, I can see the point to that. I really can. I mean, one of my favorite animated movies, How to Train Your Dragon. As cliched as hell. I mean, yeah, they were Vikings with Scottish accents for some reason. And yeah, it has to do with dragons, and it's based on this really good book series and everything like that. But if you look, again, look at the emotional beats, look at the will they, won't they deal between Astrid and Hiccup. And yes, it's cliched as hell. But I still love the film because I don't know what it is about the cliched story, but it does touch me. You know, I've come across the injured dog that I've nursed back to health and made something. Our cat, Brianna, upstairs, when we found her, there was nothing to her. And we've nursed her back to health, and she's become a wonderful part of our family. But I think that this is a story that everyone can relate to. Even if you have had a pet that you can do that with, like in the case of Hiccup and his dragon, or me and Brianna, or me and Tumbleweed.
Well,
I think everybody has had, you know, that friend that they've been able to lift up or something like that. This is a universal story, again, that touches something in the back of our reptile brains.
But then why? Why is everyone so afraid of anything different? Such as, let's go to the 1985 movie Brazil. How, when Terry Gilliam fought like hell to get the real version and the real ending of that movie into theaters, studio executives, no, it's too dark. You kill the hero. The audience wants to see the hero get the girl, so we're just going to end the movie there. For those that don't know, the last half hour all takes place inside his mind as he's being tortured to death and he dies. So basically they said, we're going to keep out the part where you reveal it was all a dream. There, happy ending. The audience is happy.
Because I think most audiences, again, I don't think that they go to films or anything like that. I think it's a very small audience that goes to films and say, I want to see something provocative. I want to see something different. And I want to see something challenging. I think that that is a small audience of people.
So you're calling me a cinema snob?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Because I don't like cliches.
Yes. Yes, I am.
Elaborate, please.
Simple. Two types of film. We've got the lowbrow film that, again, it's Avatar, the perfect lowbrow film.
I wouldn't even call that lowbrow.
Dances.
No brow.
Dances with Wolves. Titanic. Lowbrow, universal, big old cliche stories. Filmmaking 101. Every 5 minutes, every 1 minute, blah, 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 blah. Sorry, that was my phone.
I was going to say, what the fuck was that?
But you've got all of this stuff that, but it somehow touches something in, like I said, in the back of our reptile. It's a movie I can go, I can enjoy the pretty pictures, I can follow the story very easily. It's not challenging. It's kind of fun. It gives me plenty of action with which to shove popcorn into my face, and it's a place where I can go and I can put down all of my daily problems. I think it takes. Generally, the person that either does it for a living or doesn't make a living at this point to go and see the art film and link it all back and the highbrow stuff that does challenge the cliches and the art films and the weird, and that takes a very educated, very highbrow individual. And I think that
nurtures a cultural illiteracy, though, that it's a culture that refuses to go beyond what it's comfortable with. That's a cultural illiteracy, and it's being nurtured. And I don't think that's right. An example would be like going back to the Stargate versus Farscape. Stargate, when it was on Sci-Fi, was an episodic, self-contained, one-hour adventure where you didn't have to think.
Sure.
Farscape was a continuity-heavy character drama about the stakes of the entire universe. And Stargate got much better ratings, and it made no sense because Farscape was the far better show. But people just, they won't come in and watch the military shooting aliens, yeah! And that, to me, by playing into that, you nurture cultural illiteracy. You don't say, you know what, I'm going to make you grow as an individual, and I'm going to make you think. I'm just going to feed you what you want. Here, force feed!
And you also don't end up a millionaire.
So the fuck what?
Well, there are a lot of us that are willing to go ahead.
You know my stance on sellouts.
I know. And I don't know if that's selling out or if that's, hey, here's a chance. There we go. It's not a problem.
You're giving the audience what they want, not what they need. And I think that's the problem with cliches. You're giving them what they want, not what they need. And can you put your phone down?
I'm listening. This is work. I apologize. These are the people that pay me. These are the people that, you know, if I want to be a millionaire, I got to talk to these
people.
If
my phone rings and I answer it when we're having dinner, you slap it out of my hand.
Yes, we're not having dinner.
No, we're recording a fucking show.
I know, and I apologize, but please, seriously, if it weren't a big deal, you know I wouldn't do all this. Right.
But I apologize. But then when it comes to cliches, you do have those rare moments where, if not fleeting, where the anti-cliché does catch on with an audience, like the beginning of Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks was so different than anything that had been on TV before. And after a while, after about 6 episodes, that dropped off.
But sure,
that captured the cultural zeitgeist for a while until that became the new cliché. Not within Twin Peaks itself, with The Imitators. Do you think The Imitators watered down the originator of a cliche by perpetuating said cliche?
Yeah. That's what cliches do. You have to water it down to the point that it becomes a cliche.
What if you water it down yourself? For instance, and I'm going to be oversimplifying for my example here, Scott, the Friday the 13th movies. They're all basically the same movie, aren't they?
Okay, yeah.
So Paramount watered down their own product because they were so afraid to do anything different. To be fair, this wasn't Paramount, this is once it moved to New Line, the one time they tried something truly different, it sucked. Jason Goes to Hell.
Yeah.
So does that not kind of feed into the fact that they kind of went, see, we were right to not try anything different. We just kept remaking the same movie over and over again with a new cast.
And you give the audience what they want. And again, you make a million bucks.
And I don't think that's something that should be rewarded. I don't think that's something that should be encouraged.
You don't think that giving people what they want should be encouraged?
Not if it's...
Do you want to go to a restaurant and just have people just... You know, could I see a menu? Nope, we're going to feed you what you need.
When it comes to the culture? When it comes to your mind? No. Just like the whole Twilight spinning off 50 Shades of Grey and then all the 50 Shades of Grey knockoffs. I mean, that stuff was cliched to start with. Twilight was cliched to begin with.
Right.
So that's
like Shakespearean cliched, yes.
So that makes me wonder, why did Twilight catch on the way it did?
But again, it's that love story that there's something in those cliches that strikes a chord so deep in us that it still resonates. And yes, cinema snobs like yourself and Brad to some extent, even though he kind of makes fun of it, and he still enjoys the cliche films.
Well, then what about when the cliche itself actually ruins the film for you?
Like
the old trope, and this has happened in 100 at least different horror movies. The killer's dead. The monster's dead. The alien is dead. Whatever it is. And it does the one more, before it dies.
Yes, the big jump scare.
Since you're expecting it, it doesn't work, does it?
Yeah, it still does in many cases.
Because
it
you
still
know
does.
It's coming.
It still works. I don't know why, but there are plenty of people that I know that have seen this 100 times, know it's coming, don't care, still jump.
You know, it will. And then the one time I can think of where they totally played you on that was Johnny Mnemonic. Remember that?
No.
After they kill Dolph Lundgren, and you know he's been so cyberized, he's basically a metal skeleton.
He is more machine than man. Yes.
Yeah. And they start, because you got to remember, Ron Longo, he tried to make that movie anti-cliche. I mean, it really, that watch that movie and compare it to a cyberpunk movie of the 90s, he was playing against your expectations in that movie.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, you know, yay, we're celebrating, we did it, you know, we've got on the net, we broke the code. And then all of a sudden you see just like, you know, the clawed hand of Dolph Lundgren start to pick back up and the music swells. And you go, oh, fuck, they're going with this? Then the shot widens out and it's a giant magnet picking up the body to move it away. And you go, ah, you got me, because you played against what I thought was happening.
There you go.
You know, to a degree, that shot wouldn't work if we hadn't had the cliche of the monster lying always one more time after they start celebrating and walking away.
Right.
So is that now, and I've seen that happen a couple more times, has now the cliche of being anti-cliche to the monster coming back ending, that's become cliche. This is like you can only do it so many times before the cliche keeps expanding until everything is a cliche, isn't it?
Like you mentioned, 9.
Well, I don't think that's the definite number,
no,
and I'm not going to stand by
that. That's what you said. It's on record.
You know, it even comes down to the cliche. Let's say you're watching TV, and let's say it's a thriller or a murder mystery, like a Law and Order or Without a Trace or CSI or something, and you've got a big name actor in it. You know that big name actor is going to be the killer. Because they always are. The big name actor that comes in is always the guilty party.
Usually, yeah.
That is a cliche, and that absolutely destroys any sense of mystery it might have. Because you know, when Julia Roberts appears on Law and Order, she's the one behind it all. Because they hired Julia fucking Roberts to be the killer.
Right.
You know, you don't hire these people to not be the main character.
I was going to say, the one time I saw that both the not be the same character and not be the killer happen with Big Nate was when CSI brought the Mythbusters on. And they were more or less background characters.
Yeah, I was going to say, they only had like a little cameo, really, if I remember that episode right.
A couple of them.
You know, but, you know, or you do have ones that weirdly play against cliche. Look at Justin Bieber on CSI. As a fucking psychopathic killer.
Yes.
And you just go, I don't see Justin Bieber being good in that role, but he was chilling, man.
Yes. Yeah, he was. I will give him credit there. He was really good in that role.
And I think they specifically hired someone like Justin Bieber to play against cliche, because he's not playing a good boy, and he's playing a real badass psychopath in this. it's been a few years. Doesn't he get gunned down by like a SWAT team to take his ass down at the end of that or something?
It's not a SWAT team. It's the CSIs. It is.
Yeah, because CSIs carry guns. Oh, wait. No, they don't.
Yeah, they do.
Not in real life.
Yeah, they do.
Crime scene investigators are not allowed to carry guns. Crime scene investigators are not part of the police force. They are an adjunct to the police force.
I know, but in some of the larger cities, they still do.
So, you know, the whole, just the fact that like CSI has the CSIs arresting people and reading them their rights, you go, no, that's not how.
But anyway.
Okay. Sorry.
But anyway, you're right. Justin Bieber, I think finding somebody like him or back in his teenage days, Zac Efron or any of those teen, those, the Tiger Beat boys, any of those people that you find to play a real psychopathic badass, you're right. That's going against their expected image.
You know, it just like the first time that a major movie had the bad guy win, that's un-cliché, that's unexpected.
Right.
And now you see it all the time because everyone goes, well, we want to go against the cliché of the good guys always winning. But now the bad guy's always winning has become the cliché. So,
like the Hannibal Lecter series.
You mean the series of movies or the series horrible TV series?
No, not the TV series doesn't exist in my... I watched one episode and went, nope!
Yeah, nope, not doing this.
Nope, done. But the series of movies, but still, isn't there something kind of in the back of your mind that goes, yeah, we got to let Hannibal get away. He's a bad guy, but we're kind of rooting for Hannibal at the same time, especially at the end of the Silence of the Lambs when he's like, I'm going to have an old friend for dinner. And you're like, yeah, he was an asshole. Go eat him. You know, isn't there part of you somewhere deep down in your tiny little bit of joyful heart that's left that just kind of go, yeah, you know, isn't there part of you in there somewhere rooting for the bad guy a little bit?
It depends on who the bad guy is. In the case of Hannibal Lecter, no.
Okay.
Because he proved, and see, like, I can't side with a character who will wantonly kill. Now, if he just killed the people who deserved it or wronged him, but he was just killing co-eds and shit, you know, because... And I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't. The same way I could never root for Freddy Krueger in the later movies, the way they made him an anti-hero and made him the hero of the piece. And I'm like, no, he's a pedophilic child killer. I'm not going to root for this character. I'm not going to. No.
Okay.
And Lecter didn't escape in Manhunter.
I know.
You know,
he didn't escape. Well, he did escape in the books, but... But
not in Red Dragon.
Not in Red Dragon, but in...
But Red Dragon is what Manhunter was based off of. So the first book, he was in prison the whole time.
The first book, yes. And Silence of the Lambs, yes, he was in prison the whole time.
Till the end. Yeah, until he wore Charles Napier's face.
Yep.
Love Charles Napier.
But nonetheless, I mean... To me, though, since it is a movie and I can, you know... If we had a real-life Freddy Krueger... Meaning somebody who...
A pedophilic child killer.
No, I can't root for them in real life. In the movies, to me, there's that distinction. And there's again, I can kind of root... I can fall into the cliche and still enjoy the story.
Like, well, is it wrong that people root for Jason in the Friday the 13th movies? That they're like, yeah, get them kids. Get them ornery teenagers.
Not on the surface. And I mean, not, you know, you sit down and you're kind of like, yeah, we're supposed to root for this guy. And you get these, you know, especially if Eli Roth is the one that makes the characters the teenagers. They're such bastards, you don't feel too bad when they die. But
which is anti-logic for a slasher movie because you're supposed to not want these characters to get killed.
You feel bad when they do. Back when Halloween came out and when Friday the 13th, the very first one came out, yeah, you were supposed to feel bad for these people, and you did if you watched those movies, and you still do. Yeah,
that's what happened in the sea change. We started rooting for the killers.
We started rooting for the killers because the heroes became such assholes. Change of cliche. I'm sure that there was a movie where somebody goes, wait a minute, I kind of want our hero to die. He's a dick. And that was a break of a cliche. Now you look at some of these and you just go, I don't care about any of these characters. I want to see the gore. And that's what you get another cliche, but it's they're cliches that we can fall into.
But
that
then
work somehow.
You've also got character cliches that just don't make sense from any perspective.
Like what?
Look at now I know that I'm going to be talking about a video game, but it's a story based video game. Look at the Force Unleashed games.
Okay.
Okay. Traditionally, you are a strong Jedi warrior who is fighting to stop the evil and protect the universe.
Okay.
So they said, we're going to go opposite for this. Your character is a whiny, myopic little bitch who wants to do nothing except stay out of this and keeps getting drugged back into this battle to protect the one person he loves, who is an unrequited love too. Cliche, cliche. And you just go, the character you play in these games is such a whiny cunt, you can't care about what happens to him or his plight. People are dying, innocent people are dying all around him, and he's like, I can't get involved! And you just go, I'm supposed to root for you. Why?
Yeah.
Why am I supposed to give a shit what happens to you?
Well, you ran into the same thing with Hayden Christensen in the prequels. I mean, you want to talk about cliche-filled movies.
Well, that's because George Lucas is an unoriginal hack.
Right. Okay. But, again, whiny, myopic, selfish little bastard, and we're supposed to feel bad that he becomes Darth Vader.
Yeah, a really good script could have, not maybe the whiny, myopic bastard, but they could have made that character's fall very
incredible.
Interesting.
Yeah, they could have, had they hired a real actor and a real writer.
I don't know. Even with Hayden Christensen's lack of acting ability, a real script might have been able to be doable.
That's what I'm saying. Had they hired a real writer and a real actor, it would have done amazingly well. It would have done the original trilogy justice.
Possibly. But then, you know, you've also got, you kind of have the limitations of the time whenever something comes out, whether it's a TV show, a book, or whatnot. Like, say, classic Star Trek, 66 to 69. It was actually in the FCC rules that bad guys cannot win.
Okay.
You were not allowed to put on a TV show where the bad guys won.
Well,
the good guys had to win.
Right.
Because otherwise that was seen by the FCC as endorsing criminal activities. For example, like on The Untouchables, Elliot Ness always had to beat Al Capone. So the screenwriters were hogtied. They could not have Al Capone win even a small battle.
Right.
Because they wouldn't have, that script would have never made it on the air.
Right.
And that to me was kind of sad, that who knows how different, say, classic Trek could have been if they actually could have had the weird alien beat Kirk in an episode or something. But no, Kirk has to win. Doesn't that kind of tie the hands of the writers at the time? And now people go, oh my God, those old episodes are so cliched. And you go, kind of put them in context though, dude. You know, there's a reason that they are.
And again, but you know, I don't enjoy classic Trek any less.
No, I mean, but you might have enjoyed it more.
I don't know. And I'll never know. It's, look at Next Generation. The good guys didn't always have to win that.
That's because the FCC rules had been relaxed by
right.
that point.
And
Next Generation sucked, as we talked about.
It wasn't that bad. It wasn't the worst.
It was, well, if we don't count Enterprise as real Star Trek.
Which it's not.
Okay, then it wasn't as bad as Voyager.
You're right.
But it was still pretty bad.
You're right.
But yeah, Enterprise is not real Star Trek.
So, but see, that's the thing. I think that we're just going to kind of reach a point. There comes a point when you look at everything and go, everything in the world is all cliche.
Right, which is what I said. That,
but that's what I'm saying is I don't think that makes stories any less effective.
Well, there's also the different aspect. If you don't know it's a cliche, does it work any less on you? Like, if you didn't grow up watching all those cop can't catch the killer until he's suspended movies, the first one of those you see, might be the most cliched, paint-by-the-numbers story you can think of.
You're going to love
it. But it's the first you're encountering it.
Exactly.
So then does that not, on a cultural level, when you go back and watch the, say, of the film like To Live and Die in L.A. or Dirty Harry that started that, does that not ruin your enjoyment of the original a little bit?
No.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think it does. I don't think that cliche ruins your enjoyment of any story. I think that that's the reason that we have so many successful cliched films and cliched TV shows and cliched books.
Franchises
that, yeah, I mean, they're complete paint by the numbers. I
got one for you. Comic books, especially in the 90s. No character death in a Marvel or DC book had any weight whatsoever. Because right. You knew within a year that character was going to somehow be resurrected. It had become such a cliche that it took all power out of any kind of character death.
And you know, it's Superman and Captain America being two of the biggest comic book main character deaths. And yeah, by the time the 90s were over, it meant nothing.
You know, like Batman getting his back broken by Bane, you went... You know he's going to be good relatively soon. They're going to find some way to fix this and retcon it.
Either Bruce Wayne is going to heal and come back as Batman, or we're going to end up with somebody, you know, kind of
Asriel.
Like as Batman.
But then you had one company that did kind of buck the trend, that they were putting out superhero books. This is pre-Image. Well, no, actually, this was post-Image, but it was Malibu.
Okay.
Malibu said for the Ultraverse... that when a character dies, unless it is part of their origin, like they come back as a zombie or a ghost or something, all character deaths in this universe are permanent. This character dies, you're not seeing him again outside of a flashback.
Okay.
And I liked that. They actually said, you know what? We're not Marvel and DC. Character deaths have fucking weight
right.
in this world.
Right.
To the point where they even had one character, I can't remember his name, where he was like a Punisher style vigilante. They said every time he shows up, a main character is going to die and stay dead. And I thought that was a bucking the trend, you know, that no, this is not the resurrection of Superman. This is not the resurrection of Captain Marvel. This is not Bucky coming back as the fucking Winter Soldier. This is because character death has to mean something. And now technically it does in, you know, a arguable real world show, but in a sci-fi show, you always still kind of got that nagging feeling that, yeah, that character is always gonna, they're gonna come back in the series finale,
yeah,
they're gonna come back at some key moment,
yeah,
that, you know, characters' death being impermanent in pop culture, I think has ruined the weight of what should be character deaths.
I agree, it has ruined some of the weight of it. I think if you're a huge Spider-Man fan, then you're absolutely a diehard Spider-Man fan. The death of Peter Parker will still hold some weight.
I don't think it will, because I go back to the death of Superman thing. Everybody knew that he's not really dead. You know he's coming back, so. This doesn't carry any weight with us. You know?
Well, maybe comics are that way. I think, yeah. No, I hear you, and I kind of agree. I still think for diehard fans, when you see a character die, even though you know they're coming back, I think the dread and the weight that it holds at that point is not, are they coming back or not? It's how will Marvel...
How lame or original will a comeback be?
How are they going to fuck this up? Yeah.
And that's usually... It's not how cool will it be. It's how are they going to fuck it up?
Yeah, again, going back to Superman, and we had the multiple Supermen for a while. And
which none of them were him.
Right.
That was a nice play against, because they kind of implied one of these is the real Superman. Then it turns out, none of them were.
Yeah.
Ah, there you go. We got you.
Hey, fuck you. I can kind of see where that comes from, but I still say that when it when it comes to things overall, there is still that hero myth, that hero story that will stick around and still holds weight. And I don't know, and again, I don't know quite why, but I think it goes deep, deep inside our brains. And I still think that a cliched story can be very enjoyable, especially if they play up the cliches but play it straight and make it a comedy. Not
like
The Naked Gun.
So you mean Police Squad, the TV series?
Or Police Squad, the TV series, or Airplane. Airplane. Still a hilarious movie to this day.
Yes.
Filled with cliche, filled with satire, played to the hilt and played straight by every actor on it. Still absolutely hilarious.
And Don't Call Me Shirley.
Exactly. There's a problem in the cockpit. What is it? It's a little room at the front of the plane where the pilots sit, but that's just, that's not important right. That's not important right now.
Yeah, I'll agree with you on that, but you even have ones that take those clichés as comedy and don't do it right.
Look, Dark Shadows.
The sets of Freeberg stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's true.
You know, they actually have made the cliché of not understanding how to make fun of the cliche. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And like I said, the one that comes to my brain is that Johnny Depp Dark Shadows movie.
I don't know of what you speak.
It was awful. I finally saw that not too long ago. It's terrible.
Yeah, well, you want to hear even more awful?
Oh, and speaking of cliches, look how Johnny Depp, the actor and the character that he plays ever since Jack Sparrow. Look at Tonto. It's Jack Sparrow in Redskin. Ooh. Was that racist? A little bit. I'm sorry.
It was just a little bit, yeah.
A little bit racist. But Tonto is Jack Sparrow with fewer verbs. Oh, God damn it. That was... anyway, you know, actors themselves have become cliche. Tom Hanks will always play the nice guy. I think that's one thing that got me about one hour photo. I see Robin Williams and I think, okay, Patch Adams. Not the creep that he was.
Which might be why Tom Hanks was so interested in a movie like Road to Perdition.
Sure.
Because he wasn't playing the nice guy. He was playing and it wasn't the first time, because there was that Showtime TV series Fallen Angels where he played a hitman in that. So he was a pretty brutal sumbitch in that too. But he also executive produced that show, so he could do what the fuck he wanted.
But like I said, the one that really got me was Robin Williams in One Hour Photo. You're fucking creepy.
Yeah. Wasn't the first time he'd done that, though. He'd played a psychopath a couple of times prior to that.
Those didn't come to mind.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, the actors themselves, they fall into cliches as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Ryan Reynolds. He gets cast in the Ryan Reynolds role.
Right.
Seth Rogen. He doesn't get cast in parts. They go, this is a Seth Rogen character.
Right.
You know, Seth Rogen gets cast to be the Seth Rogen character.
Exactly.
They don't say, you know what? I really think Seth Rogen could pull off this really different type of character.
Yeah.
And sometimes when they do that, it does work critically, maybe not financially. Look at Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah.
That was a really un-Adam Sandler role.
And he did well.
He did great.
Yes. Mr. Sandler, stop with your stupid comedy movies and go back
Grown
to drama.
Grown Ups 2 beating Pacific Rim is just sad.
That is sad.
Real sad.
That is very sad.
All right. Well, we've got a cliched. We got to wrap up.
I don't want to wrap up in a cliche way. Why? No, don't push that. Don't push the button.
Push the button. I don't know. Pull the string!
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.
I feel so dirty. So very, very dirty. Good night, everybody. We'll see you next week.